The Nazi Road to the Brussels EU, Chapter 4. What the oil and drug cartel and its political stakeholders don't want you to know. The EU treaties. The oil and drug cartel's attempts to consolidate its political power over Europe. In the political arena, the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century saw the oil and drug cartel taking increasingly ambitious steps towards the consolidation of its political power over Europe, the ultimate aim being the creation of a global Politburo to defend against the threat from natural health and secure the cartel's global monopoly on patented drugs. The principal elements of these moves involved the signing of the Maastricht Treaty in 1992, the Amsterdam Treaty in 1997, the Nice Treaty in 2001, and the Lisbon Treaty, which became law, in December 2009. For each of these treaties, it should be noted that the vast majority of people in Europe were given no opportunity whatsoever to reject their government's decisions to sign away their rights and freedoms through these treaties. If the Brussels EU were a true democracy, of course all EU citizens would first have had the right to express their will via public referendums, and, in all likelihood, these treaties would never have been signed. The Maastricht Treaty. 1. Restructured the EU and opened the way to political integration, thus giving the cartel a greater degree of political control over EU countries. 2. Established economic monetary union, thus giving the cartel a greater degree of economic control over EU countries. 3. Established a common foreign and security policy, thus giving the cartel a greater degree of control over activities of the EU countries on the international stage. 4. Established consumer protection policies, thus enabling the cartel to use these as a cover for enforcing its interests. The EU's so-called Food Supplements Directive, passed in 2002, became a classic example of this, whereby Europe-wide restrictions on the sale of vitamin and mineral supplements were brought in on the grounds they were necessary to ensure a high level of protection for consumers. In reality, of course, the restrictions were intended to protect the pharmaceutical industry's multi-billion euro sales from synthetic patented drugs, which, as a result of the discovery of the scurvy heart disease connection, were threatened by the use of non-patentable therapies such as vitamins. The Amsterdam Treaty. 1. Brought affairs related to free movement of persons under the EU's legal framework. This made it necessary to create information systems on a European scale, thus giving the cartel greater abilities to interfere in the private lives of EU citizens. 2. Agreed a programme for development of Europol, the European Police Office activities, thus enabling the cartel to further its controls over the freedoms of European citizens across international boundaries. 3. Further developed the common security policy to enable the gradual formation of a common defence policy, thus providing the means by which the cartel could eventually achieve military control at the global level. In January 2010, academics at the universities of Bath and Edinburgh in the UK published evidence that manufacturers of oil, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, food and tobacco had jointly engaged in a successful long-term lobbying strategy during the mid-1990s to shape European Union policymaking in their favour. According to the study, published in the Public Library of Science Medicine Journal and reported in the Euroobserver.com website, major corporations including Shell, Bayer, Zeneca, SmithKline, Beecham, Unilever, Tesco and British American Tobacco have mounted a multi-year lobby campaign aimed at shaping the EU's impact assessment system to ensure that it emphasised business interests at the expense of public health. The form of impact assessment pushed by these multinationals was eventually brought in by the EU via the passing of the Treaty of Amsterdam. Significantly, therefore, the EU's Food Supplements Directive, which became law in 2002, utilises risk assessments as a means of bringing about Europe-wide restrictions on the sale of vitamin and mineral supplements to protect the pharmaceutical industry's sales of synthetic, patented drugs. The Nice Treaty. 1. Brought in a qualified majority voting system for the European Council, thus further reducing the ability of the individual EU member states to oppose interests of the cartel. As a result of this change, the three main cartel countries, Germany, France and the UK, along with Italy, now effectively hold the balance of power in the Council. 2. Increased and redistributed the number of seats in the European Parliament in favour of the three main cartel countries, Germany, France and the UK, plus Italy. The Lisbon Treaty. The Lisbon Treaty, which became law in the European Union in December 2009, elevated the oil and drug cartel's attempt to consolidate its political power over Europe to a whole new level. Intended to legitimise the construct of the Brussels EU, the treaty forms the basis of a future Europe that is fundamentally undemocratic, a clear and unmistakable step towards the implementation of a European-wide dictatorship. The treaty provides 1. No separation of constitutional powers, thus eliminating a key element that is essential to any democracy. 2. No possibility for the European people to democratically elect their president. Instead, the president is chosen in secret by the European political elite on behalf of corporate interests. 3. No possibility for the people to elect the 27-member European Commission. Instead, this executive level or cabinet of the European government is appointed by the European political elite on behalf of corporate interests. 4. No possibility for the people to replace the European Commission, even if they overwhelmingly consider that it has abused and reduced their human rights. And 5. No possibility for the people to prevent their rights and freedoms from being still further eroded. Designed as self-amending legislation, the Lisbon Treaty enables the Brussels EU to decide as and when it wants more powers and to take them without having to give the people a referendum. The undemocratic history of the Lisbon Treaty. The Convention on the Future of Europe, a body chaired by former French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, had originally started work on a so-called European Constitution in February 2002. The draft text for the Constitution was submitted to an EU summit in June 2003 and agreed in June 2004. In May 2005, however, the French people voted no to the constitution in a national referendum. The following month, in June 2005, the Dutch people also voted no. The constitution was subsequently put on ice for a period of reflection, and at least for a short time, it appeared possible that it might not resurface. In January 2007, Germany, under Angela Merkel, took over the EU presidency and declared the period of reflection over. A mere 2 months later, in March, the Berlin Declaration, outlining the intention of all EU member states to agree on a new EU treaty in time for the 2009 parliamentary elections, was adopted by all EU member states. The text of the new treaty, from then on to be known as the Lisbon Treaty, was subsequently released on June 4, 2007. To the shock of the French and the Dutch, however, and also countless millions of democratic people throughout Europe, 96% of its articles turned out to have been copied from the rejected EU constitution. As shock turned to anger, even Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the text's principal draftsman, was eventually forced to admit that differences between the treaty and the constitution, quote, are far and few between, and more cosmetic than real, end quote. Despite the overt deception that had taken place, the Lisbon Treaty was signed by leaders of the 27 EU member states in Lisbon, Portugal, on the 13th of December 2007. The only country that subsequently chose to put the treaty to a democratic public referendum was Ireland. In all the other 26 member states, including France and the Netherlands, both of which had previously rejected the almost identical EU constitution in public referendums, the treaty was passed by the country's national parliaments without any public vote being allowed. In Portugal, a referendum on the treaty was ruled out after pressure from British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Brown and Sarkozy rang José Socrates, the Portuguese Prime Minister, and insisted that a public vote was not necessary. Sarkozy himself had denied the French people a referendum on the treaty, despite an opinion poll showing that 58% of the country's voters wanted one. In June 2008, the Irish people went to the polls for their referendum on the treaty and voted a firm no, thus mirroring the votes of the French and Dutch on the EU constitution in 2005. In a clear and decisive show of opposition to the Brussels EU, the Lisbon Treaty was rejected by 33 out of Ireland's 43 constituencies. With a voter turnout of over 53%, any true democracy would at this point have listened to the voice of the people and consigned the treaty to the dustbins of history where it belonged. Instead, and despite polls showing that nearly three-quarters of Irish voters were against holding a second referendum on the treaty, the Brussels EU showed its true colours by demanding that Ireland voted again to produce the right result. Rather than bowing to the will of the people, as would have happened in any true democracy, European leaders responded to the no vote by giving Ireland a four-month ultimatum to explain how it could win public support for the treaty. Nicolas Sarkozy in particular insisted that, quote, the Irish will have to vote again. Subsequently, following political interference from the European Commission, widespread threats and lies to the Irish electorate, including propaganda that a no vote would condemn Ireland to economic isolation, corporate interference from the likes of Ryanair, who spent €500,000 campaigning for a yes, Intel, who spent several hundred thousand, and the drug company Pfizer, who openly warned of a, quote, flight of capital from Ireland if it voted no, and not least of all, the blatant sweeping away of Ireland's guidelines on media impartiality, thus ensuring that commercial radio and television stations did not have to give equal airtime to both sides in the debates on the treaty. The Irish people voted yes in a re-vote in October 2009. As a result, the treaty passed into EU law on the 1st of December 2009. Facts and fiction about the Lisbon Treaty. Fiction. The Lisbon Treaty does not alter the basic nature of Europe. The facts are, Article 1 of the Amendments to the Treaty on European Union and to the Treaty Establishing the European Community, contained in the Lisbon Treaty, states that, quote, the Union shall replace and succeed the European Community. In addition to this, Article 46A states that, quote, the Union shall have legal personality. Thus, it is absolutely clear that the post-Lisbon Union is a totally new constitutional and legal entity, and that the European Community, of which the 27 member states were previously members, has ceased to exist. Additionally, under Article 24 of the Amendments to the Treaty on European Union and to the Treaty Establishing the European Community, the Brussels EU can now sign treaties with other countries or international organisations on behalf of its member states in all areas of its competence. And of course, let's not forget that the EU treaty also created the posts of EU president, to which Herman Van Rompuy was appointed without any public vote, EU foreign minister, to which Catherine Ashton was appointed without any public vote, and an EU diplomatic corps. In reality, therefore, it can be seen that the basic nature of Europe has actually been substantially altered. Fiction. The Lisbon Treaty facilitates increased democratic control from national parliaments. The facts are, to all intents and purposes, Article 7 of the Treaty's Protocol on the Application of the Principles of Subsidiary and Proportionality only gives national parliaments the power to complain about things they disagree with. In effect, it merely provides a mechanism whereby an objection can be raised if a complaint is supported by one-third of all national parliaments. However, the Brussels EU is under no obligation to change or cancel any of its actions and can simply choose to override such a complaint if it wishes to do so. Moreover, should even the majority of national parliaments raise an objection to a legislative proposal brought by the European Commission, there is still no obligation for the Commission to change or cancel any of its actions. In such a situation, it can simply choose to override the complaint and refer it to be resolved by the European Council and the European Parliament. As such, rather than increasing democratic control from national parliaments, it can be seen that, in practice, the bureaucratic nature of the hoops to be jumped through makes it extremely unlikely that the dictatorial nature of the Brussels EU can be restrained via these mechanisms. Fiction. The Lisbon Treaty makes the Brussels EU decision-making process more democratic. The facts are, of all the Brussels EU deceptions, this statement is arguably one of the most disingenuous of all. For one thing, unlike in a true democracy, the European Parliament remains unable to freely initiate and enact legislation in all areas of its choosing and of its own accord. For another, and as described previously, the Lisbon Treaty created the posts of EU President and EU Foreign Minister, and mandated that both were to be appointed without any public vote. In addition, of course, the 27 members of the EU Commission, the EU's executive body, will continue to be appointed without any public vote. To make matters worse, Article 48 of the amendments to the Treaty on European Union and to the Treaty Establishing the European Community, contained in the Lisbon Treaty, makes clear that the treaty is self-amending, in that in future it may be amended without having to hold an intergovernmental conference or consult citizens via referendums. Bearing these facts in mind, it can be seen that, far from being democratic, the executive decision-making machinery of the Brussels EU is essentially that of an unelected dictatorship. Fiction. The Lisbon Treaty responds to concerns raised by European citizens and will increase legitimacy in the functioning of the Brussels EU. The facts are, given that concerned citizens in France and the Netherlands comprehensively rejected the so-called European Constitution in national referendums in 2005, the fact that 96% of the text of the Lisbon Treaty is identical to that of the Constitution, and that over 99% of European voters were not given any chance to vote on it, makes it absurd for the EU to make these claims. Furthermore, it should not be forgotten that 57% of the people in Europe who were eligible to vote on the EU elections in June 2009 protested against the Brussels EU by deliberately abstaining, whilst a further 4% of the eligible electorate cast deliberate votes against the EU dictatorship by voting for parties that are anti-EU and/or opposed to the Lisbon Treaty. As such, any notion that the Lisbon Treaty addresses the concerns of these people is delusional, to say the least. Fiction. The Lisbon Treaty does not create a European army. The facts are, Article 28A, C, 3, paragraph 1 of the amendments to the Treaty of European Union and to the Treaty Establishing the European Community contained in the Lisbon Treaty states that member states shall make civilian and military capabilities available to the Union for the implementation of the common security and defence policy. Paragraph 2 still further militarises the Brussels EU by stating that member states shall undertake progressive to improve their military capabilities and make it clear that the European Defence Agency will be incorporated into these amended treaties. What the political stakeholders of the Brussels EU said about the Lisbon Treaty, comparing it to the rejected European Constitution. quote, public opinion will be led to adopt, without knowing it, the proposals that we dare not present to them directly. All the earlier proposals will be in the new text, but will be hidden and disguised in some way. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, former French president and chairman of the convention which drew up the European Constitution, Le Monde, 14th of June 2007, and The Sunday Telegraph, 1st of July 2007. Quote, the substance of the Constitution is preserved, that is a fact. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, speech in the European Parliament, 27th of June 2007. Quote, the good thing about not calling it a constitution is that no one can ask for a referendum on it. Giuliano Amato, former Italian Prime Minister and Vice Chairman of the Convention which drew up the European Constitution, speech at the London School of Economics, 21st of February 2007. Quote, the substance of what was agreed in 2004 has been retained. What has gone is the term constitution. Dermot Ahern, Irish Foreign Minister, Daily Mail, Ireland, 25th of June, 2007. Quote, virtual incomprehensibility has thus replaced simplicity as the key approach to EU reform. As for the changes now proposed to be made to the constitutional treaty, most are presentational changes that have no practical effect. They've simply been designed to enable certain heads of government to sell to their people the idea of ratification by parliamentary action rather than by referendum. Dr. Garrett Fitzgerald, former Irish Taoiseach, Irish Times, 30th of June 2007. On whether they intended citizens to be able to understand it. Quote, they decided that the document should be unreadable. If it is unreadable, it is not constitutional. That is the sort of perception. Imagine the UK Prime Minister can go to the Commons and say, look, you see, it's absolutely unreadable. It's the typical Brussels Treaty. Nothing new, no need for a referendum. Should you succeed in understanding it at first sight, there might be some reason for a referendum because it would mean that there is something new. Giuliano Amato, former Italian Prime Minister and Vice Chairman of the Convention which drew up the European Constitution, recorded by Open Europe, the Centre for European Reform, London, 12th of July, 2007. Quote, the aim of the constitutional treaty was to be more readable. The aim of this treaty is to be unreadable. The Constitution aimed to be clear, whereas this treaty had to be unclear. It is a success. Karel de Gucht, Belgian Foreign Minister, Flander Info, 23rd of June 2007. On the Irish voting no to the treaty in 2008. Quote, all of the political leaders know quite well that if the similar question was put to their electorate by a referendum, the answer in 95% of the countries would probably have been no as well. Charlie McCreevy, Irish EU Commissioner, Irish Times, 27th of June, 2009. On the French voting no to the European Constitution, with which the treaty shares 96% of its content, in 2005. Quote, France was just ahead of all the other countries in voting no. It would happen in all member states if they have a referendum. There is a cleavage between people and governments. A referendum now would bring Europe into danger. There will be no treaty if we had a referendum in France, which would again be followed by a referendum in the UK. French President Nicolas Sarkozy, speaking at a meeting of senior MEPs, The Economist, 14th of November 2007. On stripping power and sovereignty away from the people, quote, I don't think it's a good idea to replace this slow and effective method which keeps national states free from anxiety while they are being stripped of power with great institutional leaps. Therefore, I would prefer to go slowly, to crumble pieces of sovereignty up little by little, avoiding brusque transitions from national to federal power. That's the way I think we will have to build Europe's common policies. Italian Prime Minister Giuliano Amato before he became Vice President of the EU Constitutional Convention. Interview with Barbara Spinelli, La Stampa, 13th of July 2000. The oil and drug cartel brings Nicolas Sarkozy to power in France. Nicolas Sarkozy was brought to power by the oil and drug cartel in France in 2007. The son of a Hungarian aristocrat, his rise to power in election had formed part of the cartel's Plan B. In the event that the White House in the US was lost to forces less friendly to the interests of the cartel than President George W. Bush, which was eventually the case when President Barack Obama was elected in November 2008, the cartel needed to make sure that other influential governments could immediately substitute for that loss. In this situation, nuclear-armed France was a prime candidate. Sarkozy's rise to power was strategically built up by the cartel in 2004. While still being Minister for the Interior, he coerced the marriage between French pharmaceutical dwarf Sanofi and Swiss-German drug giant Aventis Hoist. The Hoist Corporation, the most valuable bride in this forced marriage, was of course one of the infamous corporate trio, together with Bayer and BASF, who had brought Hitler to power and financed the preparations for World War II, including the construction of the Auschwitz concentration camp. With the move of the Hoist Corporation from Germany to France, all the know-how shifted to that country too. How to build up political stakeholders, seize executive control, build up quasi-dictatorial regimes, and ultimately seek global dominance. The diversification of economic power and political know-how away from post-Nazi Germany to France was one of those perfect camouflages that are hallmarks of the cartel. The election campaign of Sarkozy was almost a direct copy of the last elections in pre-World War II Germany. The election campaign of the cartel's candidate was financed by French oil, drug and nuclear energy corporations, accompanied by cartel media propaganda. In much the same way as in the 1930s, Sarkozy ran his divisive electoral campaign on hatred of foreigners and immigrants in an effort to scare mainstream France and drive it into the arms of the cartel candidate. Sarkozy even went so far as calling disenfranchised juveniles in Paris suburbs scum, thereby deliberately incinerating the political climate and presenting himself as the law and order candidate. After seizing power in May 2006 elections, he, together with Germany's Chancellor Merkel, enthroned himself as the new leader of the Brussels EU construct in a fashion often resembling that of medieval emperors. But Europe was not enough for Sarkozy and his corporate sponsors. 2 years into the office, he proclaimed himself as the leader of a Mediterranean empire, forging more than a dozen countries bordering the Mediterranean Sea into the cartel's reign. The joint EU-Mediterranean Empire strikingly resembles the extent of the Roman Empire at the time of Julius Caesar. One of the historic figures beside Napoleon, Sarkozy is apparently striving to emulate. When one looks at what he has to offer to those countries, the desperate nature of Sarkozy's 21st century ventures in Europe, North Africa and the Middle East become obvious. At a time when the entire globe is ready to embrace hydrogen and other renewable forms of energy, not just for driving cars but also covering major parts of the total energy supply, Sarkozy, like a desperate salesman, is trying to use outdated nuclear technology to coerce dozens of developing and threshold countries into a fateful dependency on the oil, drug and nuclear energy cartel. In the eyes of the cartel, Sarkozy is apparently the ideal replacement for George W. Bush as the primary stakeholder of its global interests. Masonic and mafia infiltration, fraud, corruption, propaganda, and the erosion of civil liberties in the Brussels EU. Corruption amongst its officials has been a constant problem within the European Commission since its inception. The standing of its commissioners on moral issues can perhaps be best summarised in the context of an event that took place in November 2004. Rocco Bottegalloni, a devout Catholic and personal friend of the then Pope John Paul II, had been appointed as one of the new members of the European Commission. Shortly afterwards, he was rejected because of his staunch Catholic beliefs, which he had publicly defended. Bottegalloni was replaced by Franco Frattini, an intimate ally of Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. As reported in The Times in London in November 10, 2004, upon his departure, Bottegalloni added a warning shot, saying that during Frattini's confirmation hearings, "I hope that nobody asks him if he is a Freemason." Despite this open warning, Frattini became the deputy president of the European Commission with, ironically, responsibility for justice, freedom and security. In this capacity, between 2004 and 2008, Frattini personally oversaw the grafting of legislation that would curtail civil rights across Europe and essentially affect every sector of the lives of EU citizens. This episode, as innocent as it may seem, casts a revealing light on the moral values of the Brussels EU. Freemasonry has been a highly sensitive issue in Italy since 1981, when a secret and illegal right-wing Masonic lodge known as P2, Propaganda Due, was broken up amid public scandal. Notably, therefore, Silvio Berlusconi, the then Prime Minister of Italy, was revealed to be amongst the almost 1,000 names listed as its members, who included senior figures in banking, business, and intelligence services, journalism, the military, and politics. Berlusconi, who in 2009 was linked to a mafia bombing campaign by a mobster-turned-witness, is alleged to have joined P2 in 1978. Historically, P2 is well known to have had links to Nazism and extreme right-wing groups. Lucio Gelli, its former Grand Master, was jailed in 1998 for corruption and fraud in connection with the Banco Ambrosiano scandal and has been openly described by the New York Times as, quote, a known fascist. The investigative writer David A. Yollop, in his book In God's Name, An Investigation into the Murder of Pope John Paul I, even alleges that Gelli was involved in a conspiracy that led to the murder of Pope John Paul I, who reigned for only 33 days in 1978. Even more disturbingly, some sources, including the New Zealand Herald and the Observer newspaper in the UK, allege links between P2 and state terrorism. Others, meanwhile, such as the BBC, state it had connections with both the mafia and right-wing terrorist groups. Speaking to the BBC in 2000, Paul van Buitenen, the whistleblower who's exposing a fraud and mismanagement in the European Commission under Jacques Santer brought about his resignation, spoke openly of his fears of mafia and Masonic infiltration in the Brussels EU. In 1999, the entire European Commission, led by Jacques Santer, was forced to resign en masse after the publication of a whistleblower report. One of the main targets of the report was French Commissioner Edith Cresson, who was accused of having committed serious and repeated fraud, falsifying contracts, forging other people's handwriting, and embezzling EU funds for her personal gain. During her time as a commissioner, Cresson even went so far as to hire one of her close acquaintances, René Berthelot, a dental surgeon, as a highly paid EU advisor on HIV/AIDS, despite the fact that he had no expertise in the subject whatsoever. Berthelot was later judged to be unqualified. He produced 24 pages of notes of little or no value in over 2 years of work for Cresson. In 2006, the European Court of Justice declared that Cresson had acted in breach of her obligations as a European Commissioner. The allegations that eventually brought down the Commission were raised by the Dutch MEP Paul van Buitenen, who at the time worked as an auditor in the Commission's Financial Control Unit. As punishment for his whistleblowing, EU officials disciplined him for violating procedural rules, reduced his salary by 50% for 4 months, and transferred him to a low-level job monitoring outlays for such objects as light bulbs. But compared to some EU whistleblowers, Van Buitenen got off lightly. In 2004, Marta Andreessen, the European Commission's former chief accountant, was sacked for alleging that EU bookkeeping was riddled with slush funds and fraud, despite the fact that her claim was clearly supported by the published reports of the EU auditors, who, by 2004, had refused to sign off the bloc's accounts for 10 years, citing presumed attempts at fraud. The EU Civil Service Tribunal rejected her bid to have the dismissal annulled and upheld, in a 55-page judgment, every single complaint made against her by the Commission. The Galvin Report, named after Robert Galvin, the EU internal audit official whose name is on its front cover, was written at the end of 2006 as an audit of the expenses and allowances claimed by a sample of more than 160 MEPs. Its findings included serious and repeated anomalies in payments for office assistance and services, dubious large cash payments made to staff and service providers over and above salaries, improper registration and tax compliance, lax or non-existent invoicing, and opaque or unrecorded expense claims. The existence of this shocking report was kept secret until February 2008, when news of its existence was made public by a British MEP, Chris Davis. Even then, its contents remained secret, and a select group of MEPs were only allowed to read the report individually in a locked and guarded room. After news of the report broke and they were accused of perpetrating a massive fraud, MEP voted not to publish it and to keep their expenses scammed secret. Even Eurojust, the EU's so-called anti-crime agency, has been involved in corruption scandals. In December 2009, for example, the head of Eurojust, José de Mota, resigned after he was suspended for 30 days for having put pressure on Portuguese prosecutors in order to stop a corruption probe involving Portuguese Prime Minister José Sócrates, according to the UPI news agency. Sócrates is accused of accepting kickbacks while serving as Portugal's Minister for the Environment in return for approving a construction project on protected lands. Far from operating in a transparent manner towards its citizens, the Brussels EU runs a vast propaganda machine that is funded at taxpayers' expense. According to Maria Ranka, who runs the Swedish think tank Timbro, for example, the unelected European Commission provides funding far in excess of its official €230 million communications budget to EU-sponsored radio stations and websites. The examples she cites include the European radio network Euronet and the EU's YouTube channel EUTube. Similarly, Ranka also alleges that broadcaster Euronews receives €10.8 million a year of Brussels EU funding, while the Brussels and Maastricht-based European Journalism Centre, which trains future reporters, is said to have been given a €1 million grant in 2008. Clearly, therefore, when organisations such as these receive large amounts of funding from a political entity, serious questions have to be asked regarding their objectivity. But that's not all. For according to Ranka, the Brussels EU also provides funding for organisations such as the Centre for European Policy Studies, the European Movement, the Europe for Citizens and Friends of Europe. Given how strongly pro-EU these organisations are, it would seem reasonable to assume that such funding may simply be being allocated as a means of substantiating the claims of the Brussels EU that civil society supports its policies. Thus far, the Brussels EU propaganda efforts have mostly been directed towards citizens of voting age. In future, however, it seems likely that its attentions will be extended to include children, citing supposed lies and mistrust being spread about the Brussels EU, for example. Some members of the European Parliament are now calling for school pupils in all 27 member states to be forced to take European Union lessons. Without any doubt, however, the envisaged curriculum, which would supposedly cover subjects such as the Founding Fathers and how the EU affects everyday lives, will not result in school pupils being taught the real facts such as those found in this book. The Brussels EU has put much effort into maintaining the illusion that it's protecting the human rights and fundamental freedoms of its citizens. All of its deceptions in this area, its Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought, is one of the classic examples. Set up in 1988 to honour individuals or organisations for their efforts on behalf of human rights and fundamental freedoms, the Sakharov Prize is awarded by the European Parliament each year at a formal sitting in Strasbourg. Whilst we would obviously not wish to in any way diminish the bravery and selfless efforts of some of the outstanding individuals who've won this award over the years, the fact is that it is deeply disingenuous for the Brussels EU to make such an award whilst it's simultaneously building a surveillance state that monitors citizens' private lives, erodes civil liberties, flouting of basic principles of democracy by preventing its citizens from being able to choose their representatives at the executive level of government, and taking steps to prevent citizens from availing themselves of scientifically proven, life-saving natural therapies and information about them. End of chapter 4.